Good afternoon. The Labor, Industry, Veteran, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is customary with this committee, we will start with the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. Republic,
which it stands,
one nation,
under God,
indivisible,
liberty and justice for all.
Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Chair Eklund, present. Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, present. Representative Detmer.
Present.
Representative Detmer, present. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, present.
Representative McDonald, present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg, present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Bliss, present. Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson, present. Representative Frederick. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Poston, present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Sundin, present. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Petrie. A quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes. Representative Greenman, have you looked at the minutes from the February 23rd meeting?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I move the minutes.
Representative Greenman moves the minutes from February 23rd, 2022. Any questions or deletions? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have two bills and two informational hearings on the agenda today. The first informational hearing is from Representative Long, House File 2005. Welcome, Representative Long. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you so much for giving my bill an informational hearing today. House File 2005 is about simple fairness for public sector unions and making the case for employees about the benefits of union membership. The Janus decision in 2018 upended 40 years of long-held understandings of how labor law worked in the United States. As a result, it's necessary to update Minnesota's laws to clarify what rights public sector unions have and to protect public employees against being targeted based on their private data. Unions are democratically elected, certified collective bargaining representatives charged with representing all employees, and therefore they have unique and legitimate needs for employee information that the general public does not. This bill provides union representatives a fair shot to make their pitch for union membership to public employees, including the right to meet with employees as part of new employee orientations, the right to use meeting space during breaks, the right to contact employees electronically, and the right to have access to new hire employee data regularly. It also authorizes employees to elect to deduct union dues from their salaries and requires public employers to honor union certified lists of deduction authorizations. This would also importantly protect employee data. Often public sector employees are being targeted and even harassed by organizations with only one goal, which is to undermine the democratically elected union. This can include visits to their homes, mailers, and emails. And these workers are entitled to privacy from such harassment. The bill would also protect public employers and labor unions from liability for being sued based on prior interpretations of case law around how fair share fees operated. And it allows arbitrators to protect private employee data. These steps, Mr. Chair and committee, would restore some balance in the ability of union representatives to contact new hires and protects union members against being targeted by third parties. I believe there are a couple of individuals who are interested in speaking to the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. The first testifier is Brian Elliott, Executive Director, SEIU, Minnesota State Council. Mr. Elliott, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Long, members of the committee. My name is Brian Elliott, and I'm the Executive Director of the Service Employees International Union, Minnesota State Council. SEIU represents approximately 65,000 workers statewide who provide care and support for Minnesota families in our homes, in hospitals, public schools, nursing homes, hotels, universities, and the Twin Cities' largest public and private buildings, as well as those who make and distribute products used by Minnesotans every single day. Their home care workers, LPNs and CNAs, their custodians, school bus drivers, dietary staff, paraprofessionals, security officers, and many, many more who we now know of as essential workers. These essential workers we represent have continued to work on the front lines throughout this pandemic, and roughly 60% of them are covered by the state's Public Employees Labor Relations Act, or PELRA. So both this bill and House File 603, which I'll testify on both together here, both of these bills modernize PELRA and add important clarifications to the rights and responsibilities of not only public employers, but also of employees and their unions, including some of those clarifications on the rights and responsibilities being particularly useful following the 2018 U.S. Supreme Court ruling in Janus, which overturned 40 years of previous case law from their decision in Abood in 1977. So in a nutshell, we support this bill because for a number of reasons. They finally recognize that we're well into the age of electronic data and electronic communication, and they address the related need to protect the personal information of workers maintained by public employers. They add clarity to the existing right, not obligation, but the right of public employees to contribute to their union out of the wages that they've earned through their own labor, as well as the responsibilities of both public employers and the union with regard to those contributions, including creating the sole liability on the union for any errors in those contributions, while also clarifying that public employers and public sector unions had the right to operate in good faith reliance on the decades of state law and U.S. Supreme Court precedent prior to the decision in Janus in June of 2018. Finally, in combination with those important provisions, these two bills ensure that public sector unions can fulfill their responsibility to work on behalf of all members of the bargaining unit by providing for the two-way communication between public employees and their union on workplace issues in the ways that make the most sense, and not relying solely on the ways from decades ago that we used to communicate. As Minnesotans, you know, we're proud of our state and we're proud of the standard of living we strive to provide for all of our residents. But right now, the laws aren't keeping up with the times in order to ensure that our public servants have all the support they need to keep Minnesotans safe and healthy. And that's why we're supporting these two bills. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and talk about how we can make these important changes to support these essential workers who've done so much for us. I'd be happy to answer any questions when the time comes. And I thank you for hearing this today.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Please stick around in case there are any questions and this one and the next bill. Next up, Ed Reynoso, Director of Political and Legislative Affairs, Teamsters Local 320. Mr. Reynoso, welcome back to the committee as well. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My honor to once again testify before your committee. My name is Edward Reynoso. I'm the political and legislative director for Teamsters Local 320. I'm here to testify in support of House File 2004. Now, there are many reasons why we support this legislation, and these are just a few of the following reasons. First of all, it allows for deductions of other purposes besides dues. Provides access by the exclusive representative to members at their work site. Provides access to new hires during orientation, which is really important for us, and updates the process that will allow dissemination of information via email system. Provides and allows the use of bargaining unit workplace for a meeting, and requires a public employer to notify the exclusive representative of new hires. Again, Mr. Chair, this is a long overdue piece of legislation, we believe, and for these and many other reasons, we offer full support of House File 2005 and stand for any questions if there are any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. As the same directions last time, please stick around if there's any members' questions. Any questions or comments from members? It's not like this bunch should be quiet. All right, Representative Long, any final comments for the committee?
I don't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the testimony and support of this bill, and appreciate members hearing it today. I think this would be a common sense way to help rebalance our labor rights in the state and give some additional guidance and clarity.
Thank you, Representative Long, for presenting this bill. Next up, we have an informational hearing on a similar topic, House File 603 from Representative Jordan. Representative Jordan, I understand you have an A8 author's amendment for your bill. Representative Jordan, please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. This is a technical amendment in nature that was developed after some consultation with smaller locals.
Any comments or questions on the A8 author's amendment for members? Okay, all those in favor of the A8 author's amendment to put House File 603 in the shape the author prefers, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. Representative Jordan, please introduce your amended bill.
Thank you, Chair Eklund, and members of the committee, and thank you for having me today. Minnesota has a strong commitment to collective bargaining. Over 400,000 of our fellow Minnesotans are members of unions, which is just over 16% of our workforce. For the past 2 years, working people were forced to deal with a global pandemic, social crises, and economic uncertainty. Minnesotans are responding by organizing new workplaces and expanding existing unions. Our state has recognized the importance of collective bargaining for decades, but the term working conditions is not broad enough for all of the challenges our workers face. House File 603, as amended, first addresses lapses in our state law necessary to comply with the Supreme Court Janus decision by guaranteeing union access to all new hires at work sites so they can explain their rights at work, including the right to join a union. Protecting employee privacy from bothersome solicitations by classifying designated addresses and phone numbers to provide it to licensing agencies as private data, and explicitly barring claims for back dues collected during the 40 years in which the Supreme Court said collecting fair share fees was legal. This bill was heard last session in education policy and includes sections specific to collective bargaining for educators because we know that educators care about more than their compensation. They want more control over the learning environments in their work sites and the future of their profession, and it's time for state law to reflect that. This bill would expand the subjects of mandatory bargaining to include class sizes, frequency and use of standardized tests not mandated by state or federal law, setting safe student-to-staff ratios for ESPs who work with students. Two of the largest school districts in the state, including my own, have filed notices to strike because of their interest in negotiating for the learning conditions their students deserve. We cannot pretend any longer that this is not a working condition our public employees face. In order to address the inequities that have become so visible during the pandemic, we need to have more conversations about our students' needs, not less. This bill recognizes the power of public decision-making and allows for more transparency about how staffing decisions at our schools are made. Please support House File 603. And I stand ready for any questions. And I also have a number of testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. We have a few testifiers here. Mr. Elliott, do you have additional comments on this bill? Or were your comments, I thought you said your comments were for both, but if you have additional, you're welcome to comment here.
Mr. Chair, no, my comments applied to both bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Next up, Kate Schmidt, elementary school teacher, Rosemont Apple Egan School District, and she is also president of Dakota County United Educators. Ms. Schmidt, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and committee members. My name is Kate Schmidt, and this is my 32nd year as an educator. I'm an elementary school teacher in the Rosemont Apple Valley Egan School District. I'm currently on leave serving as president of Dakota County United Educators. I've also been on the negotiations team in my district for 12 contracts. That's 24 years. I'm also a member of the Education Minnesota Governing Board. With your indulgence, I'd like to explain why I'm here today. Anyone who goes to college to become a teacher doesn't think they're going to end up being the teachers union president. I know I didn't. As a full-time release president, the hardest decision I've had to make in my life was to leave the classroom. I love my kids. After much discerning, I felt I had to do it for them. I left my classroom because I truly believed I could advocate for a better school experience for my students. I'm here today for students. I believe my testimony today can give you insight into a public school classroom. And I'd like to talk about how House File 603 addresses some important shortcomings in our bargaining laws that could improve public education for all students. As Sydney said, educators care more about their students than they do their compensation. They wouldn't go into teaching if they were worried about making a lot of money. I've witnessed this as a negotiator for over 25 years. Every 2 years, we survey our members before we begin bargaining. The pattern has been consistent for over a decade. Teachers' responses on our negotiation survey show more interest in making changes to educational programming decisions for the benefit of our students rather than for our own pocketbook. We need smaller class sizes, fewer assessment requirements, and more support professionals. Teachers want to provide input and have some control over the learning environments in their work sites and the future of their profession. They want this input and control to help benefit their students. It's time for state law to reflect this. It's a couple of things I'd like to highlight. First, class size matters. I have personally experienced class sizes ranging from 17 to 33 in my fourth or fifth grade classrooms. There is no comparison in the quality of education my students received when they were in a class of 17 compared to a class of 33. The year I had 17 students in my classroom only happened because my school received a federal magnet school grant that year. And I knew my students better than any class I had before. I knew their skills, interests, their dreams. That class of students showed the best growth in learning I have ever seen in my career. And I have to say that they were also one of my most challenging classes. As a team leader in my school, each spring we sit down and as a leadership team and look at our school budget and make decisions about class sizes for the following year. The intermediate or upper elementary teachers always advocated for the primary classrooms to have lower class sizes because we know it is better for our students. I tell you this to demonstrate that teachers will sacrifice themselves in order to do what is best for students. Allowing the public to witness how educators can negotiate over proper class size should be part of a systems change. Secondly, frequency and use of standardized tests not mandated by law. Teachers are not opposed to tests. We're the ones who invented them. However, we also understand the importance of the timing of the tests, the number of the tests, and what type of tests make learning most effective. The information is important. It helps us evaluate patterns of teaching and learning. Standardized tests have clearly helped us identify topics and students that need more attention. Unfortunately, over the course of my 32-year career, I've seen an exponential increase in the number of assessments given to students over the course of a year. Test preparation and practice has taken over our curriculum. As an elementary school teacher, I am asked to give an individualized reading and math assessment to each of my students, whether they are below, at, or above grade level learning. While I'm assessing that individual student, the rest of my class is asked to engage in managed, independent, quiet learning. It takes approximately 30 to 45 minutes to complete each assessment. If I have a class of 25 students, which I have not had in many years, that means 12 hours of class time is lost each time I give a reading assessment and each time I give a math assessment. If I am required, like I am now, to give those assessments three times a year, in math and reading, 75 hours of direct teaching time is lost. My district also uses MAP testing, We are asked to give that test to students in math and reading, which takes a minimum of an hour each time twice a year, another 4 hours of direct instruction lost. For context, my students have lost approximately 940 hours of instruction in a normal school year. A loss of 79 hours is significant. I'm sorry, I want to say that again because I wasn't clear. My students have approximately 940 hours of instruction in a normal school year. A loss of 79 hours is significant. It's almost 10% of the school year. Allowing the public to witness how educators can negotiate over the frequency and use of standardized tests is important. Finally, the student to staff ratios for ESPs who work with students is really important. Let's admit it, schools are being asked to do more and more each year. I'm lucky enough to work in a school district that we have a licensed school nurse in every school. It still isn't enough. The number of students with food allergies, underlying health conditions, and injuries is overwhelming. A school nurse in our high schools is responsible for over 2,000 students. They are helping students with their diabetes, concussion from sports, teen pregnancy, and a wide variety of other issues. The pandemic has also highlighted the mental health needs of our students. If we are serious about meeting our students' needs, we need more counselors, social workers, and school counselors. How can we possibly meet the needs of individual students when our counselors are responsible for 400 or more students each year? Our special ed classrooms who need paraprofessionals have just taken a hit this year. There are just not enough paraprofessionals out there. So teachers understand the important role of all these individuals and the role they play in our schools to help kids learn. And I think these changes in House File 603 will help be part of a systems change that can make our schools better. In closing, I encourage you, if you haven't been in a classroom since you were in school, please visit a school in your district and talk to the students and teachers. You will be amazed at how different it is since you went to school and the amazing things that students and teachers are learning and doing today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt, and thank you for your long career. I think you and my wife probably started in the education profession about the same time. So anyway, next testifier is Paul Terry, instrumental music teacher from Osseo School District. Mr. Terry, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hey, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Paul Terry, and I'm in my 21st year of teaching. I'm currently a music educator in the Osseo Area School District and also serve as the lead negotiator for our teachers union. However, most of my time is spent teaching students how to make music. I've had the pleasure of teaching a wide variety of grade levels from fifth grade all the way to 12th grade, and sometimes all in the same school year. Currently, I'm teaching fifth through eighth grade at four different schools. I'm here today to speak about how House File 603 can help support students and educators. As a music teacher, my own class sizes can vary widely. My smallest groups are 3 to 4 fifth grade beginning band students. I see them for only 30 minutes one time a week, but they're able to make such great progress because I can focus on the needs of a few students at a time, ensuring that everyone understands concepts before we move forward. My fifth grade general education colleagues with whom I share students are not as fortunate as I am. Their class sizes at times having 35 students, all with a very diverse set of needs. To ask one person to be able to handle the needs of 35 other human beings at one time and also ensure that they're properly prepared for middle school is an enormous responsibility. At the middle grade levels, our class sizes are much different. In grades 6 through 8, my students see me every other day in classes of 30 to 45 students. Some of my colleagues teach this type of schedule for 5 class periods, meaning that they have approximately 400 students that they see every 2 days, and some do it without any additional support. As educators, we're tasked with building relationships with students and helping them gain the skills to positively contribute to their communities for a lifetime. My question is, how can we do that when we have difficulty remembering all of their names? When a student has an individualized education plan or a 504 plan, things can get much more complicated. Oftentimes, we can have 3 or 4 students in one class that need modifications to their daily classwork. These legally required modifications must be individualized for each student. To be able to provide that level of service to students without proper support is next to impossible. To have ESP support for special education students in all of their classes would make the learning environment significantly better for all students. Special education students could then get the extra support they need to be successful every single day. Students with IEPs deserve the same music education as their general education peers. At the high school level, we're able to see students every single day. It's such a great pleasure to make music with them on a daily basis. However, the class size situation also changes fairly drastically. I see my colleagues in physical education and technology education classes with so many students, they no longer have enough computers or equipment for the number of students in the class. At one point in my last teaching assignment, I had 110 students in one class. Had the fire marshal visited us, I'm not sure what would have happened, as we've had too many students in the one room. I've outlined just a few of the issues that students and educators are facing in classrooms every day, and I truly believe that our contracts provide a unique opportunity for teachers to advocate for our students directly to the school board and to district administration, so that they can see and hear right from the professionals in the classroom what students need to succeed in the classroom and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Terry. Had trouble unmuting myself. At least I didn't start talking first. Anyway, final testifier is Ed Reynoso, Director of Political Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 320. Mr. Reynoso, welcome back. And do you have any comments on this bill?
I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for the honor of testifying in front of your committee. Edward Reynoso, I'm the Political and Legislative Director for Teamsters Local 320. We are in full support of this legislation. One thing that it definitely does, it streamlines the election process that provides a voice for workers and provides a voice for part-time workers, which in addition to that has many of the same components as the last bill that we heard. You know, I also want to call out and let my brothers and sisters know that we're in solidarity with the people that answered the calling of being a teacher. We are in full support of them, and that's a tough job. Kate just mentioned 940 hours a year. That's 11,280 hours before they get to graduate. That's a lot of time. More power to you. But we're in solidarity with our brothers and sisters that have answered that calling to be teachers. And again, a lot of the same components as the last bill we heard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. We have a couple of members' questions. Hands up, I see Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question I've got is related to privacy. Are the teachers, or the people that are hired, are they allowed to opt out of the process and mark their information as private and not shareable, Mr. Chair?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Raleigh. I do wanna mention that point in the bill will be going to judiciary as well at some point, so that privacy issue will be examined by that committee. But I do know that Ms. Luger from Education Minnesota is on the call and could better answer that question for Representative Raleigh.
Ms. Luger, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and welcome, or thank you for welcoming me to the committee. And Representative Raleigh, could you repeat your question briefly?
Yeah, absolutely.
Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can a person underneath this bill opt out of providing their personal information, such as a personal cell phone? I'll just use that as an example.
Ms. Luger.
As written, that's not currently in the bill.
Representative Raleigh.
So why would the union need the personal cell phone number of the individual? Because it requires the home telephone number, a work telephone number, the home telephone number, and the personal cell phone of the person. And I'm just worried that, you know, why do they, if a person has that and they don't want to share it, the words in here say shall, meaning that the employer must share it. I'm really worried about that.
Ms. Luger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Raleigh, that's a good question. And, you know, for the most part, union activity has to take place outside of working hours because during working hours, staff are working. And so that information is intended to permit folks to be able to contact people for whom they have a bargaining obligation in a way that won't interfere with their obligations at work.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So again, what I'm worried about is, let's say a person has a home phone number and they also have a cell phone number that they've put on file with the employer, because this is geared in section five, it's geared towards the employer giving out this information, and it utilizes the word shall. And the reason I'm continuing to ask this is, if I'm an employee and I share my information, such as my personal cell phone, for, let's say, emergency contact purposes, the way that I see this bill being constructed is the employer is required to share even that information, which I may consider private, but it looks like this bill would make it not quite public, but must be shared or shall be shared with the representative employee organization, Mr. Chair.
Representative Raleigh, I think they've attempted to answer this. I think with this bill being an informational status, that I'm sure the bill author will take a look at that and maybe consult with whether there's language that needs to be changed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the final, like, this is kind of along the same lines of it. Are there current laws that this is replacing that currently protect a teacher from not wishing to join the union? What I'm looking for is, does this fundamentally change the rights of a teacher not to join the union? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Raleigh. To your first question, I think that is a good point, and I'm happy to look into that. To your second point, no one is compelled to join a union in the state.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, that was my question. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I had some of the same questions as Representative Raleigh, and I just wanted to share with everybody there that, you know, I was a teacher for 34 years at Forest Lake High School, and teach in the area of health, physical education, outdoor education, and a head wrestling coach, and also soccer and track, and retired in 2007. And by the way, I am trying to get the rule of 90 back. Maybe teachers would like that, but we'll see what happens if I get a hearing on that. But anyway, I think a lot of these issues in this bill could be addressed with the local school district. We have elected officials on the school board. I've spoke many times in front of the school board over the years. And I think we have elected officials there that can make some of these decisions for their local school. I don't know if we need to put some of these things in statute. And I would hope that the author would take a look at that and maybe, you know, check with local schools and the school boards and see if this is something that we really need to put in statute. And if I was coming out of college right now, I would, as a young person, I would definitely go into education. And it's been a great career that I had. And I think we also need to take a look and put some more responsibility on those local school boards working with, you know, I was a member of the union for all 34 years. And we need to take a look at how we can support those local school boards. Thank you.
Representative Jordan, any comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, first of all, happy birthday, Representative Detmer. And thank you for all of your service to students. I loved PE when I was a kid. It was, still wish I had it, but more time to play outside too. Anyway, to your point, I think this is the bill that actually empowers school districts to have these conversations. What I hear from educators in my district and what I hear from educators across the state, I heard this when I was a union organizer and I hear it now as a legislator, is that they want to have these discussions with their school boards and with their district negotiations team, but they're not having it because school districts are interpreting the statute as these are subjects that they do not have to bargain over. But teachers feel that they want more avenues to bargain over these issues. This doesn't prescribe that a class size must be X number of students or that this is the safe staffing ratio. This just empowers districts and educators to have those conversations and negotiate.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. And yeah, and along with the school boards, I should have mentioned the parents. because really the parents, really my mind, okay, this is my opinion, are responsible for the education of their children. And we have more options now for educating our young people, whether it's a public school or charter schools or Christian schools or homeschooling. We have a great opportunity in Minnesota to provide options for parents and their families, because one type of school doesn't fit all students. And I think most teachers agree with that too. So I would encourage you to maybe the author to check with some parents and see what they think about what we're trying to do in this legislation and get some feedback from parents. Because, parents, who pays the bills? The parents do. And who pays our salaries? The parents do. Taxpayers. So with that, I just want to thank you for allowing me to speak my mind on this issue of being a career educator. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Any final comments, Representative Jordan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, and thank you to all of our testifiers. I look forward to working on this bill, and I think it's an important bill to show our educators that we respect them, and we know that they have a lot to say over the learning conditions of their students. So I'm happy to work with people moving forward, but it's a good bill, and I hope to earn your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And Representative Detmer, did you have a final comment, or did you just not take your hand down? Okay, sounds good. It's doggone technology. We need to be doing it in person. But anyway, next up, we have a bill from Representative Nelson, House File 3395. Representative Nelson, I understand that we have an A22-0345 author's amendment. Representative Nelson, can you please move your amendment, move and introduce your amendment.
I'll move the A22-0345 amendment. And what this bill, what this does is, it looks convoluted, but it basically, last session, they put a time at the end of the Public Employee Relations Board. And what this does is extends that out, and the bill itself actually funds that purpose, the Public Employee Relations Board.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any questions from the members on the A22-0345 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Motion passes. Representative Nelson, please move and introduce your amended bill.
Mr. Chair, just one question. This is going to civil law from here? Or is it going to?
I believe it's going to judiciary, finance, and civil law, yes.
Okay. I move House File 3395 as amended to be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Mr. Chair and members, what this bill does is, like I stated before, it funds the Labor Relations Board that we currently have. This board was recreated back in 2014 by a bill introduced by Representative Lyndon Carlson, but we have not funded it other than having one person working for it, which cannot handle what the Public Relations Board is supposed to do. What this does is fund the bill and continue that funding out so they can actually do their job. The other thing that the bill does, it has to do with data practices, which data, again, this is public employee, this employee data, what is classified, some is private, some is non-private, some is public data, and also specifies which meetings are open and which meetings are closed. And that's the major part of the bill. But the big thing, as I said, it does is it funds the Public Employee Relations Board. Why is this important? The Public Employees Relations Board is there so that when there are disputes between employers, the public employers, and the employees, that they have a place to go to work those things out in a cost-effective manner. Currently, if there's a dispute, it has to go to court, and because there isn't a functioning Public Employee Relations Board. So those things end up in local court, and then that's a lot more expensive, not only for the unions, but for the public employers. By having the Public Employee Relations Board and having people on that board that understand public employees and public employee law, they can then solve these problems at a lower expense for everybody involved. And there are a few testifiers that would like to testify in the bill, so I'll let the testifier speak.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. First testifier, Devin Bruce, Public Affairs Coordinator, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Mr. Bruce, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, a union that represents more than 15,000 state employees across all agencies, boards, and commissions. I'm here to testify on behalf of MAPE and many other public employee unions in support of House File 3395, which provides crucial data practices changes and funds the full implementation of the Public Employment Relations Board, or PERB. With full implementation of PERB, employees will have an accessible forum to challenge unfair labor practices, or ULPs. After numerous partial funding requests over the years and costly delays for implementation, employees and employers subject to the current court process is prohibitively costly and can take far too long to come to an agreeable resolution. Many other states have already demonstrated that the PERB creates an accessible forum to challenge ULPs, and we urge you to make sure the process is adequately funded to offer meaningful remedies. A list of our coalition partners include the Law Enforcement Labor Services, Education Minnesota, the AFL-CIO, Ask Me Council 65, MAPE, the Nurses Association, ATU Local 1005, Operating Engineers, the Interfaculty Organization, Middle Management Association, Council 5 of AFSCME, SEIU, and numerous others. The creation of the Public Employment Relations Board was a significant step towards bringing protections of PELRA to employees and making it cost effective, and it's extremely important that we're successful. We ask for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Bruce. Please stick around in case there's any questions. Next up is Meg Luger, Public Employees Relations Board member. Ms. Luger, you're wearing multiple hats today. Welcome back to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. My name is Meg Luger. I am, in this hat, the labor representative to the Public Employment Labor Relations Board. And until July 1 of last year, the board was open for business. And for the board, business meant resolving public sector labor disputes in the most effective and cost-efficient way possible. And as you're likely aware, the board is charged with investigating and reviewing complaints of unfair labor practices. So certain types of disputes between employers and employees in the public sector. And this allows the board process allows them to resolve those disputes without resorting to costly litigation for both sides. And the board has done its job on what I can only imagine is the tiniest budget in all of state government. Our budget is such that right now, as Representative Nelson noted, we're unable to hire full-time staff. So we've never been able to hire a permanent person. We've never been able to hire anybody over a 0.3 FTE. We've been lucky to find folks happy to work at this level, but we would really like to be able to hire an actual executive director and individuals who have administrative support staff. Additionally, last year, we were able to reserve the first part of our biennial allotment to operate last year, but there's no way we could continue to operate in this fashion on $125,000 a year. That was never intended to be an operational budget. That was a getting it stood up and get the rules passed budget, which we did. So we would like our jurisdiction restored, and we'd really like to have our work properly resourced. We need to be able to hire staff, we need to pay contractors, and we need to meet our basic operating expenses. The legislature, you all created this agency, and I know that the pride in the work that you do means that you will support it functioning properly and with appropriate resources. Public sector employers and employees depended and can depend on the board to fulfill the mandate that you gave us. And we ask that you ensure that we can do that by fully funding us and allowing us to carry out our deliberative work in the fashion that other agencies are. And that's the genesis of the request for the open meeting law changes. And we can certainly talk more about that if there are questions. if you fully fund us with the current request, we will still probably be one of the state's smallest agencies. I promise we don't have a strong growth potential here. We just want to be able to do our work. And real talk, I think we may be the only agency in the state that kind of gets kicked around existentially every year, but please make this the year that we get the funding we need with the tails that we need so that we can have an ongoing mandate to help employers and employees work stuff out without having to go to court. And thank you, Representative Nelson, for carrying this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Luger. Please stick around if there's any questions. Final testifier, another person has been busy today, Ed Reynoso, Director of Political and Legislative Affairs, Teamsters Local 320. Mr. Reynoso, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Long time no talk. Again, pleasure to testify before your committee again today. We are in full support of this legislation, and I don't want to repeat what everybody else has already said with regards to data and the public data and what should be private, what shouldn't. But at the most important issue of this component of this legislation is the funding and the appropriation of $500,000 per year for 2022 and 2023. Critically important. Purpose is extremely important for members and employers. So again, thank you so much. And we hope that this moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reynoso. Please stick around. Member questions, Representative Raleigh.
Well, that was quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. So to the bill's author, I've been reading about this and trying to get up to speed and reading some of the history. Does the PERB itself exist right now, or is it does it exist only on paper?
Chair Nelson.
It's my understanding that it exists now, but at a shoestring operation, that they don't have a full-time staff. It was, as Ms. Luger said, they have partial staff, and they're not able to do the investigations needed when these things come forward. Therefore, these things fall into district court level, which then, again, that costs the state or the employers, public employers, more money and costs the unions more money than what a functioning PERB board would be able to do, be able to work these things out with people that understand public employee law and be able to work these issues out so that they don't have to go to court.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And has the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services weighed in on this, on the PERB?
Chair Nelson.
Not to me, no.
Okay, Mr. Chair, has anyone in this committee heard from the Commissioner of Bureau of Mediation Services? I've got a note here that there has been contact from him. And I want to substantiate what my question is. I don't want to put words into the commissioner's mouth.
Representative Raleigh, as chair of this committee, I have not heard from the commissioner. Chair Nelson, I don't know if you have any other comment on that.
He has not reached out to me, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was being a very cautious on it. I want to make sure I'm not going to say anything that has been contradicted by others. I've heard that the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services said that the PERB is not needed, and I'm trying to substantiate that. So I'll do some research and get back to Representative Nelson. So thank you for the ability to ask questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Any other member questions? Chair Nelson, any final comments?
Again, members, This is a board that was recreated long past. There used to be a public employee relation board in 2014. Representative Lyndon Carlson passed the bill to reestablish this, but we've never fully funded it. We've never funded it to be able to do the job that it's intended to do and live up to its charge. Again, this saves money for the state and for the other public employers. It saves money for the public employee unions. And so therefore, it's by funding this, we'd be saving money for all the people involved that when they have disputes, they can get them worked out in a more cost-efficient manner.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Chair Nelson renews his motion that House File 3395, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Detmer, yes. Representative McDonald. Representative Berg.
Berg, yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Yes.
Representative Edelson, yes. Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Frederick, yes. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Yes.
Representative Sundin, yes. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, no.
Representative McDonald, no. And Mr. Chair, we have 9 ayes and 4 nays.
By a vote of 9 ayes and 4 nays, House File 3395 is on its way to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Chair Nelson. Finally, members, we have my bill, House File 3620. I will be turning over the gavel to Vice Chair Zhang.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Chair Eklund, we have your bill, House File 3620. Would you like to move and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment is pretty simple. It's after discussion between home manufacturers and Department of Labor Industry. It just inserts some language to make sure that we have the proper training and that sort of thing that are required to make this bill work.
All right, so it looks like we've got the bill introduction and then you have the A3 author's amendment. Is that correct?
I move the A3 author's amendment. That's what I just explained, Mr. Chair. The A3 just puts the bill in the condition I want it, and it's a compromise between Department of Labor and Industry and the home manufacturers.
All right, thank you, Chair. All those in favor of the A3 author's amendment to out of House File 3620 in the shape that the author prefers, please say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. The motion passes. Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3620 is really a pretty simple bill, and the bill addresses Minnesota's shortage of licensed manufactured home installers. There's approximately 70 licensees in the state available to complete both new manufactured home installations and used home installations by following Minnesota's approximately 11,000 licensed residential contractors to install used manufactured homes. Upon completion of 3 hours of approved continuing education related to manufactured home installation, the amendment would add the requirement that installers sit for 3 hours of specific manufactured install training. Additionally, the amendment adds three words to current law, which permits another option for how homes are labeled by the manufacturer, which is necessary for resale. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have today Mr. Mark Bruner, President of Minnesota Manufactured Home Association, that can further discuss the details of this bill.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Oh, yes. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative and Chair Eklund for bringing the bill. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota, and we represent the builders of manufactured modular homes in the state, as well as the nearly 1,000 licensed manufactured home communities. And Chair Eklund did a good job of explaining the bill. It's pretty simple. The amendment did add a requirement that for a residential contractor to install a used manufactured home, they'd be required to take 3 hours of in-person or online training, simply submit that course completion certificate to the department as verification. And then it also allows a homeowner, instead of only being able to look at a label on a home that oftentimes is missing or has been had siding placed over it after 20, 30 years, to also look at what's called a data plate, something that's in every manufactured home that tells you when the home was constructed and to make sure it has the appropriate snow load and is in the right thermal zone and all that's necessary to sell the used manufactured home under the current state building code. So at the core of the bill, what it would do is expand the number of eligible contractors to reinstall a used manufactured home. We have four plants building homes in the state, and they're all dealing with supply chain issues, lumber shortages. And once they get a home constructed, what they're telling us is they have a problem finding someone who's licensed to install that new home. You need to be a licensed installer to do that. So what the bill would do then is allow potentially the 11,000 licensed residential contractors to reinstall a used manufactured home, freeing up the licensed installers to do the new homes. And under labor and industry policy right now, residential contractors can make alterations to manufactured homes, do roofing work, and other repair work. So it all seems to fit quite nicely into sort of a qualified group of existing contractors to do the work. Plus, our members build modular homes. And for a modular home to be placed on a foundation, it needs to be done by a licensed residential contractor. So there's already a subset of contractors doing modular homes. This would just allow them to do the used homes. And we appreciate the Department of Labor and Industry and working with us on this component for the 3 hours of continuing education. And I'd be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berner, for that overview. Chair Eklund, sorry, can you, for the record, can you introduce your motion again and refer it to the Housing Committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I got ahead of myself or lost in my notes, one or the other, but I'll move that House File 3620 be referred to Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee as amended, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for that, Mr. Bruner. We got ahead of ourselves on your testimony.
Okay. All right. Chair moves the House File 3620 into the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee as amended. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed say nay. All right, motion passes. Thank you, Chair. And do you have any other testifiers, Chair?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. I think we got ahead of ourselves there too, because we didn't get any members' comments before we passed the bill. Yeah. So we maybe better circle back and another good way to say that we need to start getting these things done in person so we can have control of things a little bit better. So I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And we'll open up for comments or questions from committee members. And first is Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. And to Chair Eklund, does this include, destination trailers or things that are put in a park? Or does it deal with those types of housing?
Chair Eklund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Detmer, I don't believe it does. And I know we have some, I hope we have some people here from Department of Labor and Industry that could answer that question. But I believe this is just for modular homes, and destination parks would be a different story. But Department of Labor and Industry can correct me if I'm wrong.
Thank you, Chair Eklund. Mr. Reese?
Yeah, apologies for interrupting. We need to redo that previous motion. Technically,
even though we did it out of order, we did do the motion. There was a vote taken. So technically, there's nothing in front of the committee at the moment. I think if Representative Eklund would like to reconsider the previous motion, you can take a voice vote on that. That would then put the motion back in front of us to move the bill to housing. That way, it's properly before the committee for discussion, debate, further amendments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Technically, we are at the point now where we are done on our agenda because we have voted on the bill. So I think someone needs to, just someone who won the prevailing side, suggestion, Representative Eklund, to reconsider the previous motion, take a vote on it, and then get it back before us. I think that's would we clear up some of the confusion from the parliamentary point of view.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the previous motion.
Okay. All those in favor. All those in favor.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. All right, motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Reese, and thank you for everyone on the Zoom call for your patience. Back to you, Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I believe somebody from Department of Labor and Industry is here to answer Representative Detmer's question.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Is it McCall?
Yes, thank you. My name is Scott McCown. I'm an assistant director with the Department of Labor and Industry. And first of all, I'd just like to thank Mark for working with us on the bill. And as amended, we have no concerns. But to answer the question is, a park model would not be the same as a HUD home. So these HUDs are manufactured structures that would be set by a residential building contractor, but they do not apply to like a park model or a trailer type unit, which would be considered a recreational vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCall. Representative Detmer. Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments from members? All right, Chair Eklund, any final comments for the committee?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is, like I said, is really a pretty simple bill. And when we're seeing with the housing crisis that we see going across the state of Minnesota, in all areas of the state, this is just another way to maybe be able to help ease the housing crisis that we have. So I'll renew my motion that House File 3620 be referred to the Housing Policy and Finance Committee, Mr. Chair.
All right, we will do it correctly this time. Chair Eklund renews his motion that House File 3620 be referred to the Housing Finance and Policy Committee as amended. Mr. Petrie, please call the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Detmer, yes. Representative McDonald.
Yes.
Representative McDonald, yes. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Representative Bliss, yes. Representative Edelson.
Yes.
Representative Edelson, yes. Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Frederick, yes. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
Yes.
Representative Poston, yes. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, aye.
Representative Raleigh, aye. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Representative Sundin, aye. And Mr. Chair, there's 13 ayes and 0 nays.
All right, there being 13 ayes and 0 nays, House File is on its way to the Housing Finance and Policy Committee. Any further questions or comments from members? All right, seeing none, our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, March 2nd, 2022. We currently have two bills scheduled, and with that, we are adjourned.